Outside Corellian space, aboard the Star Destroyer Anakin Solo.
It wasn't exactly guilt that kept Jason awake night after night. Rather, it was an awareness that he should feel guilty, but didn't quite. Jason leaned back in a chair comfortable enough to sleep in, its leather as soft as blue butter, and stared at the stars. The blast shields were withdrawn from the oversized viewport of his private office, and the chamber itself was dark, giving him an unencumbered view of space. Behind his chair, a lightsaber came to life with its characteristic snap hiss, and the office was suddenly bathed in blue light. Jason was on his feet before the intruder's blade had been fully extended, his own lightsaber in hand, thumbing its blade to life, gesturing with his free hand to direct the force to sweep his chair out of the way. When it was clear, he could look upon the intruder. She was small enough that the chair had concealed all but the tip of her glowing weapon. On the other side of the desk stood his mother, Leia Organa Solo. But she did not carry her own lightsaber. Jason recognized it by its hilt, its color. It was the lightsaber Mara Jade Skywalker had carried for so many years. Luke Skywalker's first lightsaber, Anakin Skywalker's last lightsaber. Leia wore brown Jedi robes, and her hair was down, loose. She held her lightsaber in a two-handed grip, point up and hilt back, ready to strike. "Hello, Mother. Have you come to kill me?" She nodded. "I have." "I don't think so. I'm prepared for any tactic, any ploy you're likely to use." "Likely to use? Don't you know that the whole book of tactics changes when the attacker has chosen not to survive the fight?" Her face twisted into a mask of anger and betrayal. She released her grip on the lightsaber hilt with her left hand and reached out, pushing. Jason felt the sudden buildup of force energy within her. He twisted to one side. Her exertion in the force would miss him. And then he realized too late that it was supposed to. The force energy hurled past him and hit the viewport dead center, buckling it, smashing it out into the void of space. Jason leapt away. If he could catch the rim of the doorway into the office, hold on there for a second or two it took for the blast shutters to close, he would not be drawn out through the viewport. But Leia's own leap intercepted his. She slammed into him, her arms wrapping around him, her lightsaber falling away. Together, they flew through the viewport. Jason felt coldness cut through his skin and deaden it. He felt air rush out from his lungs, a death rattle no one could hear. He felt pain in his head, behind his brow ridge, from his eyes, as they swelled and prepared to burst. And all the while, Leia's mouth was working, as though she were still speaking. For one improbable moment, he wondered if she would talk forever, rebuking her son as they twirled dead throughout eternity. Then, as in those last seconds he knew he must, he awoke, once again seated in his comfortable chair, once again staring at the stars. A dream or ascending? He spoke aloud. "Was that you?" And he waited, half expecting Lumaya to answer. But no response came. He turned his chair around and found his office to be reassuringly empty. With a desktop control, he closed the blast shutters over his viewport. Finally, he consulted his chrono. 15 standard minutes had passed since the last time he checked it. He had at most 10 minutes of sleep. He put his booted feet up on the desktop, leaned back, and tried to slow his racing heart and to sleep.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars: Legacy of the Force, Exile, by Aaron Alston. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
Coruscant, Galactic Alliance Transportation Depot, near the Jedi Temple.
The Beetle Nebula settled down to a landing on an elevated docking platform adjacent to the blue, mushroom-shaped transportation depot. The maneuver was smooth and gentle for a craft so large. At 200 meters, the Freebooter-class transport was an awkward-looking vessel anywhere but in space. From above, she looked like a crescent moon, bisected by a knife blade, the blade point oriented in the same direction as the crescent tips. And her wide, curved stern put observers in mind more of fat-bottomed banthas than of sleek, stylish vessels of war. But that wide stern could carry large volumes of personnel and materiel. And in the moments after the ship settled onto her landing pylons, a dozen loading ramps came down and began disgorging streams of uniformed soldiers, many on leave, others riding repulsor lift-based medical gurneys, being guided to hospitals. From a much smaller platform 50 meters from the Beetle Nebula's starboard bow, Jedi Master Kip Duren watched the event unfold. Kip saw the jade shadow on an approach angle straight toward him. The craft approached the depot at a speed slightly faster than safe, then rapidly decelerated and dropped to a smooth repulsor lift landing atop the platform, mere meters from Kip. Soon enough, the boarding ramp descended, and down trotted Luke Skywalker and Mara Jade Skywalker. Kip offered a smile and extended a hand to Luke. "Grandmaster Skywalker." Luke took it. "Master Duren." "And Master Skywalker." Mara gave him a nod of greeting, but Kip detected a trace of irritation or impatience.
"Master Duren?"
"Aunt Mara. Oops, hello, Kip. Master Duren."
The voice was Jaina Solo's, and Kip looked up to see the diminutive Jedi at the top of the boarding ramp.
"Jaina."
Kip gave her a friendly nod. Giving Kip a brief smile, she returned her attention to Mara.
"So, can I take Zek and Ben to the temple now?"
Mara nodded.
"I think so. Kip, any reason to delay?"
"No."
He glanced to the left, where the nearby Jedi temple was clearly visible just past the jade shadow's stern. Jaina turned around, and the boarding ramp lifted into place, concealing her.
"How is Zek?"
Kip asked.
Mara looked unconcerned.
"He'll make a full recovery. The surgeons on Hapes were very proficient, but he'll be out of action for a while."
Her expression became concerned.
"How many people know how it happened?"
"Just me, for the moment."
Kip gestured to the far side of the platform adjacent to the depot.
"My speeder's over here."
Once they were all moving toward his vehicle, he continued.
"I was assigned the investigation on this one."
All lightsaber accidents that caused any harm to a living being had to be looked into, and any master on duty at the temple might be randomly assigned the duty of investigation. Mara's face set.
"Everybody who witnessed it said it was an accident."
Kip nodded.
"Of course, and Luke's report makes it pretty clear what happened. So I should dispense with our customs, not investigate at all, take the day off."
They reached the platform edge, and Kip's airspeeder, a long, narrow yellow vehicle with comfortable seats in front and a back seat that looked as though it were scaled for children. Kip hopped into the pilot's seat and extended a gallant hand for Mara. She gave him an admonishing look and leapt past him into the front passenger seat.
"No, of course not,"
she sat.
"I'm just a little touchy about it, I suppose. My son has a lightsaber accident. Suddenly I feel the eyes of all the Jedi in the galaxy on me."
Luke stepped into the back seat and settled behind Kip.
"So, what is this all about?"
Kip sank into the pilot's seat, activated the speeder, and pulled straight back in a speedy reverse, then put them within meters of the nearest cross-traffic stream. He swerved so he was pointed in the direction of the traffic stream's travel and accelerated, as though he were playing a Millennium Falcon simulator to merge with the stream.
"Chief Omis and Admiral Nyathol wanted to see you on your return from Hapes. They asked me to bring you. You can opt out if timing isn't good."
Mara gave him a puzzled frown.
"Is this about what happened on Hapes?"
"Sort of." Kip gave her a broad, trouble-loving smile. "This time, they want Luke to make Jason a Jedi Master."
Outside the Corellian system, aboard the cargo vessel, breathe my jets.
Captain Uron Levint was an heir to the tradition of Han Solo. That's how she saw herself, at any rate, and she was indeed a smuggler.
Nor was she a small-scale smuggler. Her cargo ship, Breathe My Jets, had hold space large enough to carry several Millennium Falcons. Nor did she always make solitary smuggling trips. Some missions, like this one, were small fleet operations. She looked at the distant star Corel through the bridge's forward viewport as she sat slumped in her captain's chair, glancing at the undersized, youthful hut and the specially designed co-pilot's couch beside her. She nodded.
All right, Blada, put me on.
Blada flipped a switch on the control panel before him. A display there lit up and showed Captain Levin's face, a live holocam feed. Levin stared into the holocam recorder.
Captain to fleet. In a minute I will broadcast the nav data for our final jump. That jump will bring us as close as the planet Corellia's gravity well will allow. And then one of two things will happen. We'll be jumped by Galactic Alliance forces, or we won't. If we're not, congratulations. The armaments and Bacta we're carrying will earn us tidy profits. If we are, our instructions are clear. Break and run. Straight down into Corellia's atmosphere. It's every ship for herself. Good luck.
She gave her viewers a brisk nod, and Blada cut the transmission.
Nav data?
Send it.
He did. The instant he did so, a one-minute cron timer appeared on both cockpit displays, counting down. It was just enough time for the fleet's captains and navigators to load the data and test it. Not enough time for them to waste and increase their jitters. More or less as a single body, the 30-odd ships and vehicles of the fleet accelerated, pointing straight for the distant, unseen planet. Those who had defensive shields activated them. And at exactly the same moment, each cockpit crew saw the stars before them lengthen and begin the axial swirling that was the visual characteristic of hyperspace entry. This jump would take only a few seconds. It took less than that. They'd been in hyperspace half the time they should have been when the stars stopped spinning and snapped back into distant points of light. Corel was larger, closer, but not as close as the sun should be. And there was no comforting sight of the planet Corellia directly ahead of them. Instead, there was empty space, decorated with the occasional fast-moving colored twinkle of light. Levin swore, but her invective was drowned out by Blada's shout.
Enemy ships, Chevron formation. We're toward the point and the two flanks are falling in our formation.
Which one's the interdictor?
One of the enemy ships had to be some sort of interdictor. A capital ship carrying gravity well generators. Devices that would project a gravity field of sufficient strength to yank ships right out of hyperspace. Blada highlighted a point of light on his display, and it began blinking on Levin's display as well. It was just at that point of the Chevron, directly ahead of Levin's ship. Levin keyed her comm.
Captain Levin to fleet. Maintain formation. Match speed with me. Our only chance...
On the sensor display, the crisp line of her fleet was blurring as each member craft vectored in a different direction.
No, maintain formation!
She couldn't keep the desperation out of her voice.
We've got to run this gauntlet at high speed!
Belay that,
came a voice over the comm. It was female and a bit rough, a close match to Levin's own.
This is the real Captain Levin. Follow your orders, scatter.
This voice was calm, self-assured. Blada nodded as if impressed.
Sounds just like you.
Shut up!
Levin put her cargo ship on a new course, vectoring downward relative to her current orientation. Blada offered up a sigh. It sounded like a bantha passing gas.
At least they can't know which vessel is carrying which cargo. Since we're not the biggest ship in the fleet, they may not pay us special attention.
Breathe My Jet shuddered so hard that Levin's teeth clacked together, and Blada shook like a plate full of Corellian spice jelly. The cockpit lights dimmed for a second. Frantically, Levint wrenched the controls around in a new direction, but Breathe My Jets was not a small, nimble craft. In the agonizing seconds it took the cargo vessel to take a new bearing, she heard Blada calmly describing their situation.
The ISD at the port tip of the Chevron formation is firing on us. The first hit was against our engines. If it hits again...
Breathe My Jets shuddered a second time, hard enough that Levint would have been thrown from her seat if the restraining straps hadn't been buckled in place. The cockpit lights dimmed again, and the displays all showed static for a second. The lights did not come up this time, and the cargo ship stopped responding to Levint's handling. The displays cleared of static, Running on emergency power, they began scrolling a list of damage sustained by the ship. Blotta watched the data roll by.
Engines out.
Thank you for the Holo News update.
Blotta shrugged.
It's been good working with you, Captain. I only wish...
Wish what?
That you weren't half a year behind in what you owe me.
He switched his main display over to follow the progress of the battle now raging all around them.
Outside the Corellian system, aboard the Anakin Solo.
In the command salon of the Star Destroyer Anakin Solo, Jason Solo stood staring through the forward viewports. He could see the last few twinkles and flashes of laser fire as this abortive space combat drew to a close. He chose not to follow the events more closely on the readily available computer displays. Instead, he reached out through the Force, sampling the ships and vehicles he could see, looking for oddness, discrepancy, tragedy. He found none. The smugglers outmaneuvered and outgunned, gave up almost to a ship. Shuttles were now moving from ship to ship, picking up smuggling crews, dropping off the personnel who would bring the captured craft back to the GA facilities, directing tractor beams. In another hour or two, this section of space would be empty of everything but a few debris clouds that had once been engine housings.
"Our agent would like to speak with you," said Ibok, a dark-haired human woman with skin the color of desert sand.
She was short and unremarkable of appearance, but had been of considerable help to him since he had been assigned to the Anakin Solo. The question annoyed Jason. Why would I want to speak with her? And please don't call her our agent. She betrayed her comrades for money. She was our temporary hireling. She is their traitor. She is nobody's agent but her own. Ibok paused, then evidently decided not to address those last few comments.
She didn't say what she wanted, but since she's already proven that she had one piece of information useful to us...
Yes, yes, Jason nodded. Where is she?
Your office.
Jason followed her back through the bulkhead doors aft of the command salon. Once in the main corridor beyond, they moved through a port side door into the office that served as Jason's retreat aboard the Anakin Solo. Waiting there were two people, a large man dressed in the uniform of ship security, standing, and a woman seated, though she rose as Jason and Ibok entered. Jason looked into the weathered face of Captain Uron Levint.
Yes.
Levint paused, apparently put off by his distant, brusque manner.
I simply wanted to find out if you had any requests or, more to the point, assignments for me before I left.
Jason repressed a sigh. First, I'd never prolong a business relationship with someone who sells out her fellows. Second, you're lying. Levint flushed, but her expression did not change.
All right. I mostly just wanted to meet you.
Ah. Jason paused and carefully considered his next words. Levint, you now have all the time in the galaxy available to you. In betraying 30-odd fellow smugglers, you have earned enough credits to pay off all your debts and start over, whether as a smuggler or something legitimate. You can cruise, you can frolic, you can relax. I, on the other hand, don't have time to spare, and you have now wasted some of it. I don't appreciate that. He turned to the security officer. Take her down to Delta Hangar. Put her on her ship and get her off my ship. Levint cleared her throat.
Breathe My Jets is on Gamma Hangar, and the engines won't be repaired for a couple of standard days at least.
That's right. I'm claiming Breathe My Jets for the current military crisis. Jason pulled his data pad from a pocket and consulted it. Your ship is now the Duracrud.
Duracrud?
Levint practically spat the name.
That's a stock YV-666 older than I am.
And exactly the sort of vessel needed by a smuggler starting a new career.
Our agreement?
Our agreement was that you would receive a sum of credits. Ibok, you showed her the transfer proof and gave her the data to claim it from the Bespin account? Yes, and that you would be allowed to depart on your ship minus her cargo. The agreement did not specify which was to be your ship. He fixed Levint with an impassive stare. Now, would you care to waste any more of my time? Levint turned away, her body language stiff, and marched to the door, her security man behind her. Then as the door slid open, she paused. Not turning back, her voice quiet, she asked,
"What's it like to have once been a hero?"
Then she left, and the door hissed closed behind her. Jason felt himself redden. He forced the anger away. It wouldn't do to let an insect like Levent bother him, but clearly additional punishment was in order. He turned to Abak. "My father used to have endless trouble with the Millennium Falcon. The hyperdrive would fail all the time, and he'd tell the universe that it wasn't his fault, and then he'd fix it and be about his business." He nodded toward the closed door. "Delay her in transit to the hangar bays. Have Durakrud's hyperdrive adjusted so that it will fail catastrophically after one jump."
"Yes, sir."
Abak considered.
"Since she's a smuggler, she's not going to go anywhere with a single jump. Her first jump will always be to some point far away from planetary systems or traffic lanes. She'll be stranded."
"That's right. And she'll become intimately acquainted with her hyperdrive."
"She might die."
"And if she doesn't, she'll be a better person for the experience. More polite, probably."
"Yes, sir."
Abak moved to the door. It slid open for her.
"Sir, your meeting with Admiral Antilles is in 1 hour."
Jason consulted his chrono.
"So it is. Thank you."
Exactly an hour later, Abak returned, escorting Admiral Wedge Antilles of Corellia. The aging military officer, upright and moving as easily as a man half his age, wore the full-dress uniform of an officer of the Corellian Defense Force and a grave expression that concealed his feelings like a mask. Jason rose from behind his desk to shake Wedge's hand. He gestured for Abak to leave, and she did so without speaking. Jason resumed his chair and gestured to its comfortable high-back double on the opposite side of the desk, situated there just for this conference. "Have a seat."
"Thank you."
Wedge did, his posture perfect, and Jason felt a tiny trickle of annoyance. Wedge had to know that Corellia was beaten at this point. He could have the decency not to pretend otherwise. "I know you don't like to waste time," Jason continued. "So do you have a position statement for me?" Now at last, Wedge did look confused, if only faintly.
"A position statement?"
"As in, it's clear the Corellian position is hopeless, so I'm here to talk sense." Wedge chuckled.
"I'm here because you suggested a meeting with a top-ranking representative of the Corellian military or government. You're here because having achieved a military victory on Hapes, one that has been spectacularly covered in the media, and let me add my congratulations on that, you want to press your advantage and conclude a peace with Corellia to give your brilliant political career one more boost."
Jason felt a flash of anger and instantly clamped down on it. "You're not in a good position to make accusations about other people's motives and ethics, not after signing off on the coup attempt at Hapes." Wedge was silent for a long, chilling moment.
"Because I think you need to know, I'll tell you something that constitutes a Corellian government secret. I didn't know about the plot against Hapes. You already knew I had nothing to do with its planning."
"How would I know that?"
"Because it failed."
Jason gave Wedge a condescending look. "You don't need to offer a defense yet. War crimes trials haven't even started. And if your negotiation is particularly skillful, they might not happen at all. So let's get back to the subject. Admiral, your position is hopeless. The Corellian system is surrounded, blockaded. Despite the fact that numerous planets made noises of support when Corellia took its stance of defiance, not one has rebelled in support of Corellia. You are friendless, and you're running short of crucial supplies. The smuggler convoy that you expected an hour or so ago is not running late. It is entirely in our hands, with all its BACTA, all its munitions, now helping the GA cause." Wedge smiled.
"First you say we have no friends, then you say people were arrested trying to bring us essential goods."
"They were smugglers, not friends."
"Sometimes smugglers become friends. Your father and I were smugglers who joined the Rebel Alliance cause.
And now since you've seized those cargoes rather than paying for them, you can be sure that fewer smugglers will become friends with the Galactic Alliance. Are you saying that the GA doesn't need friends? Or just doesn't need friends like me and your father?
You're changing the subject again.
True.
Abruptly, Wedge looked weary, reflective.
I'll be honest. I'd like to see Corellia reunited with the GA. If it isn't, something very bad will happen.
Now you're talking.
If Corellia doesn't rejoin, if war truly erupts, I may never get my pension from the GA.
Wedge,
I earned that pension. Decades of service.
Be serious.
All right, I will.
All humor gone, Wedge fixed Jason with a stare.
You're dealing with a coalition government that hasn't settled in place yet. Thrakken Sal Solo hasn't been dead very long, and the larvae are still wriggling out from under his rock. We need time to stamp them out. You don't need to hurry. You don't need our answer today, tomorrow, or next week. And any answer you provoke in a short time frame is an answer that will make everyone unhappy. Sit back, be patient, negotiate in good faith, and I have every reason to believe that Corellia will rejoin the GA.
So you'll go back and recommend that Corellia surrender to us? Wedge shook his head.
Never in 1,000 years.
What are you talking about then?
I'll recommend that Corellia rejoin the GA. Full acceptance of standard GA planetary admission terms, but no reparations. No punitive measures, no extra tariffs, no under-the-table activity against Corellians. And a genuine attempt to undo the effort to undermine the general Corellian reputation that has been taking place in the GA population. Can you negotiate toward that sort of resolution?
I could. But if we suffer any more catastrophes like the bombing on Coruscant, all bets could be off.
Understood.
Wedge relented just a bit, some of the stiffness leaving his face, his posture.
So what are you going to do when the excitement's all done? Stay on with your planetary police force? Or go back to wandering the galaxy and rescuing cubs from trees? You used to be pretty good at that.
Jason masked a twitch of annoyance by shrugging. Some combination of the Galactic Alliance guard work and resuming my studies, I expect.
Has the political bug bitten you then? Or do you just like the way you look in the uniform?
Jason sighed, exasperated. Now you're joking again, and I think we've done all we can with this meeting.
I think so too.
Serious again, Wedge stood.
Jason, may I say something to you not as an officer or negotiator, but as an old friend of the family?
Jason rose too. Something off the record, you mean? Of course.
No, on the record, off the record, it doesn't matter. As an old friend of the family, can you listen as an old friend?
Still a trifle confused, Jason nodded.
Another old friend of mine, Wes Jansen, the galaxy's least serious man, except when he's killing the enemy or trying to make a point, once said this to me. The real sign that someone has become a fanatic, he said, is that he completely loses his sense of humor about some important facet of his life. When humor goes, it means he's lost his perspective. Jason, you've lost your sense of humor about, well, everything, and you're doing things you never would have done when you were younger. What does it mean?
Jason shook his head. It doesn't mean that I'm suddenly a fanatic. It just means that I've grown up.
Coronet Corellia.
A bunker always felt like a bunker, Wedge reflected. No matter that this chamber was decorated for entertainment, it was a bunker, deep beneath the ground, and the men and women who were gathered here, politicians of the world of Corellia, and the drones who worked for them, all sat a little hunched, as though they could feel the tons of masonry and dirt heaped protectively above their heads. Politicians of the other 4 occupied worlds of the Corellian system, represented by holograms, must have been in above-ground buildings where they were. Their postures were not bent. Wedge also sat upright, both out of habit and to annoy the others, and accepted a cup of caff from one of the drones, this one a pale, slight young man in a Corsec uniform. Wedge waited until the drone had withdrawn before turning back toward the other man on the couch.
So the conversation didn't accomplish much politically, except that I think Colonel Solo will advise in favor of the Galactic Alliance giving us more time.
The man he addressed, Dur Gedjan, the Five Worlds Prime Minister and Corellian Chief of State, handsome, younger than his political acuity might suggest, dark-skinned and dark-haired, set his own cup of caff on a nearby table and frowned. "Giving us more time," he echoed. "That sounds a lot like a victor doing a favor to the vanquished."
"Obviously, they're not victors here," Wedge said. "But just as obviously, they're in the stronger position. A few more weeks or months of their blockade, and they'll starve our economy past the point of resistance. Solo was right when he said that we were alone. Unless your communications with the Bothans have had a sudden breakthrough you haven't mentioned."
"You sound defeated, Admiral."
The speaker was the hologram of a short, wide-shouldered man. The transmission of his seated form was superimposed onto a chair to Gedjan's right. The speaker had thinning hair and a face ideally suited to belligerence. His name was Sadrus Koyan, and he was both Chief of State of the World of Trollis and a member of the Centerpoint Party, the minority force within the Corellian system's new coalition government. Wedge gave him a neutral look.
"Clearly we're not defeated, but if things continue as they are, we will be. I'm telling you that we can negotiate a non-surrender resolution to this situation, rejoin the Galactic Alliance, and experience minimal repercussions, if we negotiate in good faith, starting now."
He felt his mood darken, and he knew his expression had to be doing so as well.
"Good faith may be tricky to come by, though, in a political body that uses its secret reserve fleet to execute a plan to assassinate a foreign head of state."
He was drowned out, shouted down by the voices of the others. Gedjan was saying, "Now is not the time," while Koyan roared,
"Lack of competence in keeping our access to our own shipyards open."
Denjax Tepler, former Five Worlds Prime Minister, now Minister of Justice, grimaced and spoke inaudible words of calm and caution, motioning with both hands for the others to lower their voices. Rorf Willems, Minister of Defense, was grumbling.
"Bit more cooperation is called for here."
Minister of Intelligence, Gavel Lamora, seemed to be evaluating Wedge, as if measuring him for a coffin. The drones kept conspicuously quiet, while the ministers and chiefs of state raged. Gedjan scowled and spoke up again, this time at a full-throated shout. "Shut up!" The others quieted and stared at the Corellian leader. Gedjan returned his attention to Wedge. "Admiral, are you saying that with the assault fleet, you could have kept the GA forces out of our system, kept us from suffering the blockade the GA has instituted?" Wedge nodded.
"It's very likely."
"Very likely. And you're also saying that our best course of action now is to negotiate for a no-fault return to the GA.
"Yes."
"Even though it would inevitably cost us control of Centerpoint Station."
The station, home to an ancient gravitic device that could be used to construct entire solar systems, or destroy them, had been near operational when a Jedi mission had sabotaged it, costing the Corellians their most significant weapon. Wedge nodded.
"Chief Gedjan, that result is far superior to being starved into submission and then forced back into the GA under terms dictated by Cal Omas and Admiral Nyathol."
"So we can't win?"
"Not without wealthy, powerful planetary systems joining on our side."
"Which we were within a centimeter of having," Koyan growled, "until Jason Solo and his parents fouled up our action in the Hapes Consortium."
Wedge bit down on a response. Assassinating a good ruler, such as Queen Mother Tenel Ka, so that a treacherous, deceptive pro-Corellian one could take her place might help win a war, but the peace that followed would be fragile, uncertain, even evil. However, saying such a thing before this body of men and women would do no good. Gedjan, seeming to read Wedge's reply in his expression, looked over at one of his aides.
"Bring Admiral Delpin in."
He returned his attention to Wedge.
"Admiral Antilles, we have a problem. And the problem is that I don't think you're willing to win at any cost."
"I'm not," Wedge said. "And neither are you."
"I am," Gedjan said.
"If winning meant the Corellian system was the only center of civilization to survive the war?"
Gedjan frowned.
"That's a ridiculous and extreme example."
"Exactly,"
Wedge nodded.
but I'll bet that it constitutes an example of a victory you wouldn't be willing to accept, meaning that you're not willing to win at any cost. We just have to establish for this ruling body what is the maximum consequence and victory that we're willing to accept.
Gedgen tried again, demonstrating a level of patience and even respect that Wedge found surprising. Admiral, you were kept out of the loop on the decision to, adjust Haven politics because it was clear to the rest of us, based on your history of performance, that you would never sign off on it in its final form.
You might be right.
But we're already in agreement that sacrificing the dictator of a distant government is well within the maximum consequence and victory that we're willing to bring about. The door into the chamber hissed open, and a woman in the dress uniform of an admiral of the Corellian Defense Force, the same uniform Wedge wore, entered. She was Wedge's height and was muscular of build, the sort of woman whose hobby time was probably all spent in a gymnasium. Her hair, cut close, was black and picked up blue glints from the glow rods around the room. She was about half Wedge's age and good-looking. There was no trace of makeup evident on her features. There was, however, a trace of sympathy on them as she glanced at Wedge. She came to a stop in front of Gedgen's chair, her cap tucked military-style beneath her left arm.
Admiral Jenna Delpin, reporting as ordered.
Wedge knew her. She was a fast-rising star in the Corellian Armed Forces, and had led the assault fleet in the disastrous coup attempt at the Hapes Consortium. Gedgen acknowledged her with a nod, then turned again to Wedge.
Admiral, what you accomplished in the liberation of Trollis makes it clear that we couldn't have chosen a better leader for our United Armed Forces. But times change, and your personal code of conduct is, I believe, going to become a greater impediment in dealing with your government's needs. Admiral Delpin has a clearer understanding of her role and her duties to the government, and has your skill at moving and motivating subordinates. For this reason, and understand it's nothing personal, we continue to hold you in the highest regard. I'm removing you from the position of Supreme Commander of Corellia's Armed Forces.
He turned his attention to the newcomer.
Admiral Delpin, I am appointing you to that position.
Thank you, sir. I accept.
Her voice was smooth, controlled. Wedge stood. He did it slowly and carefully, the better to mask what he was feeling. Regardless of how inevitable this moment might have been, regardless of how inflexibly he might hold on to the ethics that made it happen, being relieved of command still felt like taking a sledgehammer blow to the gut, and he didn't want anyone in this group to see how he felt. Smoothly, he saluted.
Congratulations, Admiral.
She returned his salute.
Thank you, Admiral. After this meeting breaks up, perhaps we could have a cup of caff and discuss things.
Wedge limited his reaction to a faint smile. Gedgen said,
Admiral Antilles, your tactical and strategic planning abilities continue to make you invaluable to our armed forces. If Admiral Delpin agrees, I want you to join her operations staff.
Delpin gave Gedgen a crisp nod.
I do agree.
Wedge took a deep breath.
I'm sorry, I can't, Admiral. Ordinarily, I would have no hesitation in accepting and in working with you, and for you. But circumstances are not ordinary.
He fixed Gedgen with a stare.
Sir, I hereby resign my commission in the Corellian Defense Force.
The room fell silent. A moment later, someone behind Wedge said,
Good.
Gedgen shot an angry look at the speaker, then addressed Wedge.
I won't accept.
Wedge shrugged.
You have no choice, or rather, your choice is to keep me on as a non-commissioned personnel, or offer me a full discharge. From this point on, or at least from the point I submit my resignation along official lines, I am no longer a commissioned officer.
Gedgen heaved a sigh and thought for a moment.
You can either stay on as a sergeant, a speeder pilot for our landing forces, or you can make one last public appearance as Admiral Antilles, cheerfully handing off your post and duties to Admiral Delpin, and honorably retire.
Wedge considered it. The public appearance would help convince the majority of the populace that everything was fine with their leadership, that he had every faith in the new Supreme Commander, that he supported the new regime in all its ways, which was a lie. But if he didn't do it, members of the armed forces might lose a little faith in their leadership, and that could result in breakdowns in authority and the deaths of good soldiers. Wedge's entire deliberation took a quarter second.
I'll make the appearance, of course.
Of course, Gedgen echoed. Dismissed. Wedge saluted, and a little stiff-legged made his way from the room.
Jindyne System, Tendronto Refueling and Repair Station.
The vehicle lining up for an approach on the refueling station's spinward docking bay had once been a Corellian YT-1300 transport, efficiently disc-shaped, with aggressive-looking forward mandibles and a cockpit that protruded from the starboard side of the bow to give the craft an oddly pleasing asymmetrical profile. Now, however, countless burns of battle damage darkened the hull, and the top and bottom turrets, which had once housed laser cannons, were just gone. As the craft made her last bank before the approach, the man waiting in the docking bay could see that the topside turret had not been replaced or even covered over. Where it had once been installed, there was a hole that gaped into the vehicle's interior. The waiting man would have recognized the Millennium Falcon instantly, even if he hadn't known she'd be coming to this place. He had once owned her. He still loved her. And now he winced to see what had become of her. Still urbane and handsome, and now distinguished-looking with age, Lando Calrissian stood in complete contrast with the famous transport. He was dressed in a silken ensemble that would have cost what it took to buy a good speeder, but whose components were all chosen for unobtrusive elegance. The dark blue tunic, black trousers, and purple hip cloak were subdued of color and fashion. The silver-tipped black cane he carried was his one outward concession to age. The Falcon slid gently forward on her repulsor lifts and settled down to a remarkably smooth landing. Lando walked around from beneath the mandibles to look through the cockpit viewport, but the occupants had already left, so he continued around to the boarding ramp. He had a handful of jokes in mind for the arrival of Han and Leia. I've seen transports crashed into the sides of world devastators that look better. What have you done to the old girl this time? Did you buy your pilot's license at the drunken Minox School of Instruction? But then, as the pair descended the boarding ramp, he caught sight of their faces. There was not one iota of good humor, cheer, even hope in their expressions. Just grimness, and under the surface, pain. Han wore his customary pants, tunic, and vest, and had his left arm in a sling. Leia was in brown Jedi robes. Both sets of clothes looked wrinkled and slept in. Lando cleared his throat to gain a moment to think and clear away the good-natured, mocking vocal mannerism he had intended to employ. Then he said, I'm glad to see you. I have caff and food in the lounge. While Han and Leia ate, slowly, barely tasting their food, they told Lando what had happened. Jason was the central figure in almost every element of the story. Jason supporting laws to concentrate and imprison Corellians on Coruscant. Jason interrogating a prisoner until she died, the daughter of Boba Fett. Jason believing that Han and Leia would conspire against Tenel Ka and punitively firing on the Falcon when his own parents, sister, and cousin were aboard. Cockmame and Meewal, Leia's Nogri bodyguards killed in that attack. Not just killed, but incinerated, instantly obliterated, so that there was nothing left to bury. As their account of the events ran down, Lando shook his head, almost unwilling to believe what he was hearing.
I'm sorry. I've been up on the Holo News. I knew about his promotion to head of the Galactic Alliance Guard, but all this, I don't know what to say.
Finally, Han looked up from his plate.
Can you help us fix the Falcon?
Lando nodded.
Consider it done. This place is an old repair station we picked up in a corporate merger. I'll keep this repair dock open long enough to make the Falcon ship shape. Better than new.
He winced again.
It'll take some time, though.
Han and Leia exchanged a look, and Leia said,
We'll need a fast transport for the interim, too. Something that can get us through the Corellian exclusion zone if we need to. And something that doesn't scream the Solos are back whenever it's noticed.
I've got you covered.
Corellian exclusion zone aboard the Anakin Solo.
Jason sat cross-legged in his cabin,
floating a meter above the floor, tranquil. For once, he was fully open to the Force, letting it flow through him, sustain him, support him in the air. He let the Force do as it wished, showing him pictures, flicking little traces of thought and emotion through him. And all the while he searched, peering, as if the entirety of the Force were an ocean, and he wanted to find one distant, familiar face among its waves and currents. He found it. Very far away, tiny in the distance, but demonstrably still alive. Lumaya. And suddenly, she was nearer, much nearer. She appeared in his physical vision as well, no more than 2 meters before him.
Jason.
Lumaya, he said. I'm happy to know that you've survived.
Thank you. I am healing. Here I can summon my strength. Your uncle hurt me.
Yet you don't sound angry. She laughed.
I'm used to it. Whenever we meet, I expect him to hurt me. He will probably do so until I die, or until you and I have won, and he is forced to understand us.
I'm in a holding pattern for the moment, Lumaya, waiting for negotiations with the Corellians to bear fruit, thinking about where my studies need to lead me.
Ah.
She was silent a long moment. Jason watched her breathe. It seemed to be an effort for her.
You have been considering your sacrifice. Sacrificing what you love, loving what you sacrifice.
Yes. I am becoming more ready.
Good. And you have been looking for an apprentice.
Ben is my apprentice, though I realized not long ago that I can sacrifice him if I have to.
Ben is your Jedi apprentice, not your Sith apprentice.
I am not a full Sith yet, and therefore cannot have a Sith apprentice. Her sigh sounded exasperated.
You're stalling. You don't know whether he will be fit to become a Sith apprentice. The time to learn that is now, not when you reveal yourself. You must test him.
He's back with his parents, and they don't want him to see me. Lumaya watched Jason and waited. So, he considered, I must separate Ben from Luke and Mara and test him. Lumaya nodded.
If you wish, I will coordinate the test, but you must decide what it will be.
All right.
And you must decide what to do with him if he fails.
Yes.
If he fails, will you love him less?
Jason paused over his answer. I think, initially, it would make little difference, but we would soon grow apart.
So if he fails, he will not long be suitable as your sacrifice. Keep that in mind.
I will.
Coruscant, the Jedi Temple, quarters of Luke and Mara Skywalker.
Luke and Mara kept an apartment away from the Jedi Temple, but also quarters in the temple itself. Austere chambers, for those times when late-night council meetings or other duties made it more practical to walk a few dozen meters and fall over, rather than board a speeder and fly kilometers to do the same. Sometimes those temple quarters served an additional purpose, such as when the Skywalkers found themselves in command of a surly, defiant Jedi son, who was certain that unfairness was a Force power and his parents were its masters. The silence and chill radiating from the boy's room, one door down a common hallway, were formidable. Luke, pacing, was certain he could feel them like air blowing through a Wampa's meat locker. He turned in mid-pace to look at his wife. How is it that I feel guilty? Sitting on the bed, Mara looked up from her datapad. You're feeling guilty. We are, because he's unhappy. And he's going to continue being unhappy until we stop slandering and persecuting Jason, the perfect Jedi, hero of the people and male model for black uniforms. Or until he grows up enough to revise his thinking about his cousin. She sighed.
Do you think we can brick him into his room until he does grow up?
Tempting. Luke resumed his pacing.
How long did it take you to stop being a headstrong kid who made as many bad decisions as good ones?
Luke shrugged in mid-stride.
I don't know. From the time Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru were murdered to the time I started calling myself Master, about 4 years. I'll set the timer then. It should go off when he's just about to turn 18. We can check then and see if he followed your example.
That elicited a dry chuckle. All right. We need to figure out what to do with him now. We've got him in the temple, where dozens of Jedi eyes can keep an eye on him when we're not around, which is bound to make him more paranoid and angry. What do we do to make him learn? Before Mara could reply, Luke's comlink beeped. He pulled it out and thumbed its switch. Yes?
Grandmaster Skywalker, this is Apprentice Siha in the reception hall.
The voice was female, young, breathlessly enthusiastic.
There is a man here who wishes to see you. He won't see any other master.
What's his name and his business with me?
He says his name is Twinzins Thlee. He doesn't have any identification to corroborate that. He says his mission concerns a lightsaber with a silver blade.
Luke and Mara exchanged a look. Luke thumbed the comlink microphone off.
Twinzins? Twin Sons 3?
Mara nodded. That's what it sounds like. Twin Sun Squadron was an X-Wing unit formed by Luke during the Yuuzhan Vong War more than a dozen years before.
Who was Twin Sons 3?
Mara continued. At various times, several different people. Luke thought back to a recorded holocam message he'd viewed only a few days before, a message sent by Han describing his and Leia's recent encounter on Telkor Station. Jag fell, he said. Han said he was back. As for a silver lightsaber... Silver blades were rare on lightsabers, and a woman who had once owned one of them had recently been of serious concern to Luke, though her new lightsaber had a different blade color.
Alima Rar, Mara said.
Right. Luke thumbed the comlink back on. Tell our visitor we'll be right up. The visitor was only a little over average height, but stood so straight that he seemed much taller. Dressed in a black flight suit and engulfed by dark gray traveler's cloak, his face shadowed, he looked more like a forbidding figure from a cautionary children's tale than a peaceable visitor. Luke and Mara approached the visitor. Luke could read very little from him, no sense of menace, but also not one of friendliness, perhaps a trace of anger deeply buried. Colonel Fell, Luke said. Jag bowed and offered a little heel click.
At your service, he said.
He reached up to throw back his cloak hood, revealing the features Luke remembered. His was a lean face with startlingly bright green eyes and a scar leading up from his brow to his hairline. Luke stepped forward to stretch out a hand.
Why the secrecy? You could have visited us officially with your credentials.
There are no credentials. Jag shook Luke's hand, then Mara's when she offered it.
I'm no longer a colonel, no longer an ambassador, no longer a citizen of the Chiss, no longer even a member of my father's house. Technically, that suggests I'm no longer even Jagged Fell. I'm as much Twin Sons 3 as I am anything else.
Ah, Luke considered. And if I understand correctly, your mission here has something to do with Alima Rar.
Everything to do with her.
Take a walk with us, Mara said. They walked through the halls of the temple, which were mostly dim and a little trafficked at this hour, and Jag told the Jedi Masters, in unemotional tones, of the events of his last few years. How during the Dark Nest missions, he had guaranteed the parole of Lobaka, how Lobaka had violated that parole, how the damage done by Lobaka and his Jedi friends had become the responsibility of the Fell family. How Jag had been exiled from that family as a matter of consequence and honor. How Jag had been shot down on the world of Tanupe and had survived there, a lean and dangerous existence for 2 years. How Alima Rar, mad as a half-crushed bug and carrying within her mind the dual imperatives to recreate the Dark Nest and avenge herself on Luke and Leia,
had also survived, also escaped. In those 2 years, Jack concluded, I gave a lot of thought to Alima Rar, to what she was, what she could do. Afterward, I continued researching her and investigating ways to counter her killic abilities. She can scrub herself from the short-term memory of people, meaning that you can run into her, and if you survive, moments after the encounter, you have no memory of meeting her. It makes her terribly hard to track. Her killic abilities and remaining Jedi powers make her an extreme danger to you and your sister, and to the galaxy.
So you've come here to warn me, Luke said. I appreciate that.
More than that, I come with gifts.
From a tunic inner pocket, Jag drew 2 items. One was the shape and size of a large cred coin, but silvery and featureless. No portrait of a long-dead hero or deserved-to-be-dead tyrant graced its faces, though a blob of some whitish substance adhered to one side. The other item was a common data card. He handed the card to Mara.
This is a graphical interpreter and communications program, he said. It operates in concert with most security holocam programs found in government installations, capital ships, any secure building. Basically, it evaluates every humanoid figure the cam sees, comparing them with a database of Alima Rar's unusual physical characteristics. And when it finds a match, it notifies the security department and sends a coded message to any data repository you specify. If you can get this installed on enough systems, we can perhaps plot her movements, find out her whereabouts before she does any more harm.
That may not be as useful as you think, Luke said. Alima probably knows the technique of the Force Flash, a method by which a Jedi can cause interference with holocams, even one she's unaware of, in order to avoid being recorded. Jag frowned, but he did not seem daunted.
This technique, does it make her invisible?
Mara shook her head.
No, it creates a little static on the recording, causes a sort of timing hiccup.
That's not so bad, Jag said. Part of the code involves analyzing incidence progression along a sequence of holocams, tracking an identified target. If we extend its analysis to these hiccups and assign a probability that they indicate a single force-using individual, the code could still plot her movements in observed areas.
That might be useful in detecting Lumaya, too.
Mara pocketed the card.
Thank you. Also on that card are complete schematics for this, so you can reproduce it.
Jag handed the coin-like object to Luke.
You use the sticky material to affix this to your neck or to a shave spot on your skull. You activate it by saying, Alima. Deactivate it by tapping it twice with a fingernail.
He demonstrated, tapping it as it lay in Luke's open hand.
From the time it's activated until it's deactivated, it sends electric shocks through your nervous system at 1 standard minute intervals.
Luke grinned.
That's helpful. Did you also bring me a brooch that will pinch my skin from time to time?
The shock,
Jack continued humorlessly,
is very precisely attuned to human nervous systems. I haven't had the resources to determine the exact frequency needed by other species. The specific pain generated helps cause whatever is in your short-term memory to be transferred into long-term memory.
Ah.
Luke looked at the device more closely.
Meaning that Alima...
The disc began vibrating in his palm. Hastily, he tapped it twice, and it ceased vibrating.
Meaning that she can't slip back out of your memory again.
That's right.
Mara frowned.
You know, we ought to be able to duplicate that effect with use of the Force.
Luke nodded.
It's worth researching. I'd prefer a Force technique to going through something like Circus Bantha obedience training. I'll put Master Silgal on it.
He tucked the disc into a belt pocket.
Fel, thank you. I mean that. Is there anything we can do for you?
At last, Jag sounded uncertain.
I hesitate to ask.
Don't, Mara said. I mean, don't hesitate.
I don't have anything to do,
Jag said, and his voice became curiously hollow, empty.
Except chase Alima Rar until I run her to ground and make sure she can't do any more harm. But I don't have much in the way of resources. No transportation, little funding.
He chuckled.
So odd to be living in the private sector. In the military, they give you a mission and whatever resources they can offer. Sometimes too few, sometimes too many. Repeat until you retire or die. Outside the military,
Everything is so complicated.
Luke clapped him on the back. I'll get you resources, starting with some quarters.
No, I have a room. The address and my comm code and frequency are on the data card. I'd prefer not to stay here.
All right.
I'll go now. I can find my way out.
With a final bow to the Jedi Masters, Jag turned, correctly, Luke noted, despite the many twists and turns their walk had taken them through, toward the temple's main entrance, and strode away, pulling his hood up as he walked. Returning to the temple from a late errand, Jaina passed the lone Jedi performing guard duty at the building's wide-open main entrance and walked into the main corridor. Just leaving was a man wrapped up in a dark cloak. He kept to the left side of the corridor, away from her, not even appearing to notice her. She hesitated as they came abreast of each other. His upright posture, military bearing, and the unconscious arrogance of his stride causing bells to sound in her memory. When he was one step past her, she stopped and turned her head to look at him. Jag? He stopped too, but did not turn. His face remained completely hidden within the folds of his hood. But it was Jag Fel's voice that answered.
Yes? Were you just going to walk past? Not even say hello?
Yes. And then he was gone, swallowed up by the Coruscant night beyond the doors.
Jindine System, Tendrando Refueling and Repair Station.
Hands on hips, Han stood in the lounge of the vehicle now parked alongside the Millennium Falcon.
You've got to be kidding.
If you'll forgive me, Captain Solo, Master Calrissian's vocal mannerisms, though laced with humor, do not suggest that his basic thesis was in jest.
Han glared at the gold-toned protocol droid, then returned his attention to his surroundings. The lounge was, if not a thing of beauty, a testimonial to obsessive detail. The walls and ceiling were covered by thick, velvety material in a dark blue that matched the deep carpet on the floor. Silver glowrod housings, polished to a dazzling level of reflectivity, protruded at tasteful intervals from the walls and ceilings. Furniture included four comfort couches, each with ceiling-mounted, semi-transparent privacy curtains that would glide into position or retract at the touch of a button. Controls for the couch's temperature and vibration settings were mounted on silver panels inset in the velvet walls. Leia, beside Han, nodded.
It's even more crass than the Lady Luck.
Lando, facing them from across the room to view their first reactions to the pleasure pit, smirked.
She's a bit like the Lady. An older model, a Soro Sub 2400 yacht.
What's her name?
Leia asked. Lando modulated his voice to its richest, most seductive tones.
The Love, Commander.
He stretched out the word love, an exercise in mockery. Leia looked at him as though he could not possibly be telling the truth. At his confirming nod, she put her hands over her mouth, the better to restrain any laughter that might emerge. Han shook his head.
I don't want to say what I think of her as a vehicle, but as a disguise, she's perfect.
He pulled his left arm from its sling and flexed his hand experimentally. Several weeks' worth of medical treatment since he sustained the injury and a good night's sleep had improved his condition somewhat, and his manner suggested he would soon be his old fighting self.
Let's move our gear from the Falcon to the master cabin, he told Leia.
Lando shook his head.
No, you're in the biggest of the guest cabins. I'm in the master cabin.
They both looked at him.
You're coming along?
Leia asked.
After due consideration, it seems to me that you'll be a lot more anonymous as my pilot and navigator. Me being Beskadoff Derman, hollow entertainment mogul and pleasure seeker of the corporate sector, rather than the faces the authorities see whenever they establish communications with the Love Commander, right?
Well, Leia considered, that's true, but I don't look forward to Tendra tracking us down and killing us if we get you hurt.
She'll be glad to get me out of the home for a while. She knows how twitchy I've been lately.
Lando picked up his cane and twirled it theatrically.
Come on, nameless crew. Let's get to it.
Han clapped C-3PO on his metal shoulder.
Goldenrod, you get the most important mission of all. You stay here and record every single thing they do to the Falcon during repairs. and try not to talk to them while you're doing it.
Oh dear.
An hour later, personal possessions moved aboard and pre-flight checklists completed, Han, sitting at the navigator's console, was a bit more favorably disposed toward the Love Commander. Despite the yacht's name and pleasure-oriented mission, despite her swirly, mood-altering sky blue and green exterior paint job, the vehicle wasn't a bad choice for their current needs. At 50 meters, she was nearly twice the length of the Falcon, but didn't mass much more, having a long, sleek design with two outrigger propulsion pods, one on either side, each carrying sublight ion drive and hyperdrive components. The hyperdrives were nothing special, but the ion drives had been rebuilt and overbuilt, giving the yacht considerable speed in sublight situations. Nor was she unarmed, though at first glance it appeared she was. A pop-up turret hidden beneath an artfully concealed access plate on the top hull held a turbo laser. At the bow beneath the bridge was a concussion missile port hidden behind a false dish in a sensor array. And the yacht did have shields, though the shield generator, appearing to be an auxiliary hatch, lay folded down against the top hull when not in use and would take a few seconds to raise into position and become active. Now, with Leia in the pilot's seat, at Lando's insistence, since Han was not yet fully healed, and Lando in the oversized, preposterously comfortable captain's chair at the rear of the command cabin, the Love Commander lifted ponderously from her berth, backed on repulsor lifts away from the Falcon, and slid stern first into vacuum.
"Where to, Navigator?" Lando asked, activating his chair's massage vibration. "Someplace interesting, I hope." "Should be interesting enough."
Han finished putting their course into the nav computer.
"Corellia. We're going to zip through the exclusion zone, laughing at the Alliance picket vehicles trying to blow us up. Then we're going to drop down to the planet's surface, determine whether Prime Minister Dur Gedjan was acting alone when he ordered the hit on Tenel Ka. Which probably means beating a confession out of him, and then deciding whether to forgive him or kidnap him and his co-conspirators and bring them to justice."
"Oh?"
Lando asked. "What do we do on day two?"
Despite himself, Han snorted, amused.
"We'll figure something out."
"Well, wake me when we get there, whatever your name is."
Empty space. Engine compartment of the Durocrod.
Captain Uran Levint lay on the grimy Durasteel deck, half propped up against an almost equally grimy wall, and waited to die. Her tools lay scattered on the deck, along with the deck plates she had pulled up, plates that gave her access to the various components of the Durocrud's hyperdrive. The only sounds to be heard were her own breathing and the distant rhythmic noises made by the ship's life support system. Levint knew it would take her a long time to die. The Durocrud would continue to provide breathable air for weeks. The stores of food and water would run out first, in a few days. She'd have plenty of time to record and transmit a few final messages. One would denounce Jason Solo for his treachery. One would confirm that her will, on file with an advocate's office on remote Tatooine, did accurately record her final wishes. Then she'd die of thirst. Or, if she chose to end her suffering faster, she could shoot herself or step out an airlock. But one thing she could be sure of. Given the remote, untraveled nature of the spot she'd chosen for her first hyperspace jump, no cargo vessel or fast-moving courier would ever chance upon her. And her last transmissions, traveling at the speed of light, would take 8 years to reach the nearest star. She was as alone and doomed as anyone in the universe could be.
"Delicious, isn't it?"
The voice was female and came from outside the meager light provided by Levint's glow rods. Levint jerked upright. "Who's there?"
"Your suffering, we mean,"
the voice continued.
"You suffer like a child who cries herself to sleep each night, knowing that her parents will never, ever understand. How long has it been since you were that child?"
Levint rose on shaky legs and began to edge her way back to the door out of this compartment. She reached the doorway, found the light control by touch, and activated it. The overheads came on, bright, blinding her. And then, as her eyes adjusted, she saw her visitor. And she knew she was not crazy.
because her accumulated experiences and neuroses would never concoct a being like the one she saw. Her visitor was a blue Twi'lek woman of no unusual size. She was dressed in a dark traveler's robe and black clothes. Her features were pretty, but she had obviously been the victim of catastrophe at some point in her life. Her left shoulder was lower than her right, with her left arm hanging in such a way that Levince suspected it was non-functional, and her right headtail had been severed at about the halfway point.
"Who are you?"
"We are Alima."
"Alima, and what are you doing here?"
"We are a stowaway."
Levince stared at Alima for a few moments more, and then it happened. The laugh came bubbling out of her like a high-pressure Santa spray steam. The laugh became a painful howl. It shook her and kept coming.
"Why do you laugh?"
"Because you're the worst stowaway in galaxy history."
Levince straightened.
"Because you picked the worst possible ship to stow away on. The hero of the Galactic Alliance sabotaged my hyperdrive."
"We know this. We watched his agents do it."
That snapped Levint out of her manic mood.
"You watched it?"
"Yes."
"And got on board anyway?"
"Yes."
Alima smiled.
"No, we do not wish to die. We stowed away after making sure of what the agents had done, and after acquiring the parts needed to repair the drive."
Levint took an involuntary step forward.
"You can fix it?"
"Yes. Though we will only fix it if you are dead. But if you and we come to terms, you will live and you will repair the drive."
"What are your terms?"
"You help us find the parents of that hero of the Galactic Empire. You act as a public face for us in that search. You do not reveal our presence to the authorities. You do not attack or unnecessarily endanger us. You are one of the smugglers, yes? You use your knowledge of smuggling to help in this search."
She furrowed her brow for a moment, then relaxed.
"You treat us as an esteemed paying passenger.
And once you've found the Solos,
you will have fulfilled your obligation."
Coruscant, Jedi Temple Vehicle Hangar.
It wasn't a large number of starfighters, less than a full squadron's worth. 9 X-Wings, 1 E-Wing, but they were all beautifully maintained. And Jag Fel felt an unexpected pang as he looked at them. It seemed so long ago that flying craft like these had been his whole life. He missed that. He missed belonging to a band of comrades, divided by individual needs and peculiarities and prejudices, but united in their goals and their support for one another. He let none of what he was feeling reach his face. "The Jedi Order would like to fund and support your mission," Luke Skywalker was saying. That snapped Jag's attention back to the present.
"To find and destroy Ali Marar?"
he said. "To find and neutralize Ali Marar," Luke corrected. "Yes, obviously it might entail killing her, but should an opportunity arise to capture her, transport her back here."
"So that she might be convinced to see the error of her ways?"
Jag let just a hint of mockery enter his voice. "No, so that she might find her own path to redemption." Jag considered.
"I accept,"
he said.
"Good. I'm actually heading up a similar unit, pursuing leads involving the Sith Lady Lumaya. She may be dead now, or maybe not, but what's clear is that she was in alliance with Alima as of a few days ago, when they ambushed me and Mara. Now that it's clear that Lumaya was or is employing agents, and who some of them are, we stand an improved chance of finding her trail." "I don't know much about her. I assume the term Sith Lady doesn't bode well."
"Not well at all. I'll get you the basic information on her." Luke reached into a pocket and handed items over to Jag. "Identicard. It identifies you as Jagged Fell, a civilian specialist employed by the Jedi Order. The second one's a cred card. It gives you access to a drawing account set up for your task force. The third is a security card with what you need to assume control of," he pointed, "that X-Wing. Sorry I can't provide you with a Chiss Clawcraft."
"That's all right. I'm fond of X-Wings as well."
I also want to assign a couple of Jedi to you. You're hunting a dark Jedi. You'll benefit from having Jedi with you.
I agree.
Luke glanced toward a door leading into the hangar. Speaking of which, he must have been alerted by an impulse in the Force, for when Jag followed his glance, the door was shut. But now it slid up and open, and a woman in brown Jedi robes walked into the hangar.
Uncle Luke, you wanted to see... Oh.
Jag refrained from stiffening. It was Jaina Solo. His mind clicked through a number of possibilities and arrived at one inescapable conclusion. That she was going to be...
I'm putting together a small task force to find Alima Rar, Luke said. Colonel Fell here is in charge. I'm assigning you to it and Zek when he's fit to fly.
Jaina came to a stop a few meters away, looking between the two men as if still expecting the punchline to a joke that already wasn't funny.
That is not a good idea. I don't think I can operate as this man's subordinate.
Luke gave her a quizzical look. Back in the Yuuzhan Vong War, though he outranked you, he didn't offer you any grief about being your subordinate.
I'll leave you two to get caught up. Jag, please get me a plan of operation at your earliest opportunity.
He turned and headed toward the door. Jag waited until Luke was out of hearing.
The problem with Jedi Masters, he said, is that they can't be beaten with impunity.
Jaina looked at him suspicious. Jag, did you just make a joke?
No.
He clamped down on the answer rising within him.
He knows why I wouldn't want to work with you, and he has decided to disregard my wishes. I'll have to assume that his reasoning is sound, whatever it is, until proven otherwise. All right, let's do some strategic planning.
Why wouldn't you want to? Jaina was clearly confused, and so far as Jag could tell, possibly hurt as well.
Because of what happened with the Dark Nest? It doesn't matter. We have planning to do.
He gestured toward the door. She stood her ground, glaring.
It does matter. If I'm going to be working in a hostile environment, I need to know why. If we have a problem, you should have told me about it years ago. I couldn't.
The words, heated, snapped out of him.
I was stranded on Tanupe for 2 years, and because of your actions, ignoring the consequences of freeing Lobaka and what he did subsequently, I am now barred from my family forever. And that is the why.